This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. We all want our children to be healthy when we finally meet them after 9 months of waiting, but sometimes it's just not to be. Sharing the experience of living with a child with spinal muscular atrophy are parents Edmund Lim and Lim Suki, accompanied by Professor Dr. M.K. Thong, geneticist. So firstly, I guess we have to start with this. What is spinal muscular atrophy?
Hi, thanks for having me here today. Basically, spinal muscular atrophy is a genetic disease that affects babies and children. It's a condition that causes progressive weakness in the limbs, and this is as a result of some genetic change, and this is something inherited.
From what I understand, there are diseases that are grouped within this sort of umbrella name. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, spinal muscular atrophy, or SMA, was first described based on the clinical features, meaning to say that when they were first described, the doctors were not very sure what this disease was all about. So they look at all these children and babies and they classify them based on the age of when the disease was first picked up. So they have broadly, in the initial years, break them into three large groups as type 1, 2, and 3. Type 1 is usually for those babies who became symptomatic at birth or by 6 months of age. Type 2 is those beyond 6 months to 12 months of age. And for those who are type 3, they are usually onset during later childhood or adults. So basically there's three large groups.
And you mentioned there that it's a hereditary condition. So what puts a child at risk of becoming an SMA patient?
Because it's a genetic condition, this condition is carried by parents. That means both parents are usually carriers and they are perfectly healthy and well, and they are not aware of the condition. So sometimes when two carriers marry, they would have a certain amount of risks of this condition manifesting in the children.
And there's a specific chromosome, right, that's involved in this condition?
Mm. Yes, I think there's some research in the last couple of 10 or 20 years that the gene for this SMA is located on chromosome number 5, somewhere along the long arm of chromosome 5.
And what is that chromosome actually in charge of?
Okay, this is going to be complicated.
All right.
For the listeners who are not aware of what is the chromosome and the gene, basically we are all made up of billions and trillions of cells. Within each cell, we have this thing called a nucleus, and all of us has 46 chromosomes within the nucleus. And within these 46 chromosomes, we have 20,000 genes. Okay, that's the short of it. Now, a gene is basically a recipe, if you like, which contain all the information that make up certain parts of the body, or they make certain proteins that will be essential for our body to function. Now, if you have a recipe, for example, that has a spelling mistake or a typo, in the medical lingo, we call it a mutation. So that would obviously change the message in the gene or the recipe. So sometimes this change can affect the function of a part of a body. In this case here, the gene that is has a mutation, if you like, is called SMN gene. And this gene is basically a very important gene that makes a protein that keep one of our nerve cell functioning normally. So when there's lacking of this SMN protein, the disease begin to manifest itself. So basically, in short, it's a genetic disease arising from the SMN1 gene.
So what are the rates of babies born with SMA in Malaysia who have, you know, this particular typo written in?
Well, basically, it's a rare condition, so we don't have much data on this because there's no national registry for rare disorders in Malaysia as yet. However, in many developed countries, for example, in the UK or in the USA, the incidence reported is about 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 25,000 babies, so it's quite rare. So if we were to take this number, Malaysia having 500,000 deliveries a year, so we can expect at least about 50 to 20 babies, 20 to 50 babies born a year with SMA.
Edmund, Suki, you know, when did you realize that Brandon, your son, had this condition?
When we first realized was about 6 months old. Brandon is my second son. Jaden is 7 years old now. He's from Jaden, we sort of know what are the developmental milestones and what are the expectations. Well, since birth till 6 months, Brandon has been a very quiet baby and very relaxed. We can't really hear his cry, so we thought that was pretty easy to take care. But when he was 6 months old, we thought that there was something very different with Brandon because he didn't attempt to crawl. He didn't attempt to turn over to his on his tummy. So the peds mentioned that he is a little floppy. So we started on a physiotherapy. For 6 months, we did physiotherapy. He still did not attempt to crawl, and there was no improvement. Then by 1 year old, he already put on about 100 grams, although, you know, he ate like a normal baby and all that. And I started to become really nervous. So with Google, I searched on no weight gains and hypotonia or floppy kids. The list was really long on what are the disorders. And we talked to the PET, and I mentioned that I don't feel comfortable with his milestones and with his condition currently. So what the PET did was normal checkup. He knocked on his knees and his arms and all that. There was no reaction. That's when he said we should do a blood test. So we were referred to a geneticist, and that's when we found out at 1 year old. When he was 1 year old and 1 month, we were told that he has SMA.
And what was your reaction upon finding this out, you know, finally having this diagnosis and knowing what was happening with your son?
Yeah, I guess we had a hollowing feeling that, you know, it was SMA or something like that. And then once it's confirmed, it was traumatic, right? It was extremely traumatic because all of a sudden, you know, everything we thought about in terms of our child, our lives, would change. You know, you felt dazed, we felt numb. I guess it's a bit of a blur now as you think about it because so much happened. But one of the things that struck me then was, you know, we felt lost because we didn't know where to turn, we didn't know where to talk to. This is a very rare condition. And we hit Google again, right? We hit Google. There are organizations around who put a lot of material on the web to sort of help you through the process in terms of what you should be doing. And that's what we did. We focused then on, you know, what can we do? And that helped to get us very quickly from the shock into let's get really busy because we've got a lot of things we've got to do. We're very fortunate to also have a very close friend who knows Professor Tong very well, and she managed to get us in contact very quickly. So within, I think, 2-3 days, we were with Professor Tong. And that really helped us settle down, give us direction in terms of where we're heading, what this means.
I think when we were told about the diagnosis, we were prepared for the worst, but hearing that and knowing it is totally different. Although as much as you are prepared for, when it's, you know, it hits you, you get shocked. And as a mother, I think I feel really guilty because it's a genetic disorder. So questions, and you know, they ask you questions like, what did you do? Was it, you know, your history and all that? So it adds up to that that shock. And also all I could hear was the doctor tell me is like the textbook lifespan for SMA kids is 2 years old, and Brandon was only 1 year old in 1 month then. That fear of losing him was really unimaginable. So we said that there's no time to waste. We have to accept this and move on as quickly as we can to do what we can do to let him pass through that hurdle, because we have seen cases in US or in Malaysia, people have lived through, you know, more than 2 years old.
And you both referenced, you know, the need to move on, the need to start getting busy and doing things. And what exactly did that doing mean? You know, what was there to do?
For me, it was, I spent a lot of hours researching. I spent a lot of time compiling a care manual based on what I could read, you know, started to compile things like, you know, physiotherapy, just thinking ahead in terms of everything that we would need to know or need to do. Not that we knew it then, because we hadn't had the time yet to sort of reach out. But another thing was, I felt that we just had to be thick-skinned about it and ask for help. And one of the things that I found made a difference was we decided a month after to write to all our friends and our family and just tell them, this is what's happened, this is how we're feeling, this is what we're going through, and just ask for help, right? Don't be shy to ask for help.
Prof Tong, what kind of help do you feel as a, you know, as a medical professional in this particular field, what kind of support do you need to provide for parents in situations like this with children with rare genetic diseases?
Yeah, generally, I think we have to understand what they're going through. And this is a process where medical geneticists specialize in, and that's the field of genetic counseling. Very often we, you know, sit down together with the family, the parents, and we would spend time and hours sometimes even just going through all the issues. Sometimes it's just providing genetic information. Very often the time spent might be talking about family matters, about coping strategies, about getting into a multidisciplinary action group, or basically trying to get all the relevant specialists involved. Usually we have to refer them to get second opinions, for example, the neurologist, sometimes the respiratory specialist, and nutritionist, and so on and so forth. And the most important, of course, for some parents is the early intervention programs that can be instituted to minimize the liabilities and also to maximize potential. But for the medical geneticist, it's about making things smoother for the families to cope, and also to empower parents so that they could come up stronger, that they are not alone, for example. And very important is that facing to the future, despite what signs or what information they might have read from the internet or textbooks and so on, very often we have to get down to the ground and say, look, what you read is only generalized information, but for the child, we personalize the information to what the child can do and also what the family can provide.
And I suppose to a certain extent, since it is a rare disease, numbers and what you know will be limited anyway, right? I mean,
That's
even
true.
That general information.
Yes. And it's a very difficult thing because this field of genetics is rapidly evolving. Information that we knew 5-10 years ago has quite quickly become out of date. So we have to keep refreshing the information and keeping things in perspective. Particularly, for example, most parents are devastated when they hear the child had a shorter lifespan compared to the other children. But now, with more research and information, we know that sometimes it's not true anymore. And so we have to temper our information and the counseling to something more that is comfortable for the parents. For example, we try not to talk about life expectancy because we do know that there are genetic modifiers that make a difference to the child.
I'm speaking today to Professor Dr. M.K. Tong, geneticist, as well as Edmund Lim and Lim Suk Yee. We are discussing spinal muscular atrophy, which is a rare genetic condition. Coming up, we find out a little bit more about the development and treatment options for children who have this condition on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me today are Edmund Lim and Lim Suk Yee, parents to a child living with spinal muscular atrophy, as well as Professor Dr. M.K. Tong, geneticist. We are, of course, discussing SMA. So we've established it's a rare genetic disease, and traditional wisdom has dictated that life expectancy is very much shortened. Actually, what has Brendan's development been like? He's now, how old is he?
He's 4 years old. When he was first diagnosed, he was only 1 year old. At the time, he couldn't turn on his tummy or sit without support. He still can't do this at 4 years old. However, we are pretty happy with his development. He can't stand or he can't walk till now. However, at 2 years old, he was he had pneumonia, and he was given a feeding tube. So 70% of his dietary intake was through the tube and 30% orally. But after a year, he decided to just pull off the tube, and now he's eating 100% orally, and he can talk 5 to 6 word sentences, and he can also sit without support for about maybe 20 seconds. So far, he's free from infection for 2 years. So we are pretty happy with that development.
Yeah, one of the milestones was before he would struggle to be able to lift his arm. I'm really happy to see now because he can actually scratch his head. So, you know, there's some sort of small things that we do see that gives us a lot of hope.
Professor Tong, what are the general symptoms of SMA that parents can be on the lookout for? Suk Yee mentioned some of the things that Brandon went through. Are those common?
Yeah, actually, some of the symptoms that they present with are quite common symptoms. For example, a child might have poor feeding, for example. They refuse to feed well. And sometimes they might be mistaken for poor appetite. And sometimes the child might just present with delayed milestones. For example, they may appear to be weak. And subsequently, the more obvious things would be the child will be noted to be quite floppy. The word floppy simply means that the child has the low muscle tone. So when you lift up the child, it feels like the child has no reaction to when you carry the child, for example. The other things that the child might present with is what we call not growing or not thriving so well. Sometimes they might present with difficulty in breathing. For example, you heard the child might come down with pneumonia. So all these are basically little signs that tells us that, you know, we're on the watch out and see whether the baby or the child is having weakness of the muscles.
And you mentioned muscles. This is also a motor neuron disease, if I understand correctly. Is it?
SMA involves a nerve, and because the nerve control the muscles, so you can only see how the muscle react when a brain give instruction to the muscle to move, for example. That instruction may not be translated down to the muscle. So basically, the muscles become weaker and weaker, and therefore there is loss of muscle cells, so you tend to lose muscle bulk. That's why the term muscle atrophy, because the muscle is getting smaller due to, you know, this nerve that's located on the spinal cord.
What are the muscles that will usually be affected first in this condition?
Yeah, generally the muscles that are affected first will be those large muscles, generally what we call anti-gravity muscles. So muscles that you use to hold up our heads, muscles that we need to lift up our arms, or basically just to kick or stand. So these are the most obvious features that most parents will notice, that the child is not, you know, putting his head straight up. It tends to flop to one side, or the child is having difficulty in raising the arm or kicking, for example. So those are the obvious ones.
Brandon's life expectancy was about 2 years of age. You know, Suki, you mentioned that just now. However, he just celebrated his 4th birthday. What do you both credit that with?
If we look at it from a genetics point of view, there's some research that talks about a backup gene. And it can range from 0 to, I think, 5 or 6. We've discovered that he's 3. And there's a bit more research that sort of shows statistically that, you know, if a child has 3, maybe 4 copies, he fits more of a certain type of SMA, which is not as severe as a type 1. But because it's not exact science, it looks like he's maybe borderline, strong type 1, weak type 2. But in addition to that, I guess there's a lot that we do for Brandon. There's a lot of material and there's a lot of help from the therapists and the doctors in terms of taking care of him. And we do spend a lot of time seeing them, spending time with the doctors and therapists, and bringing that home and helping Brandon with it.
Yes, I wanted to explore that a little bit more, you know, what's being done. Because as you mentioned, when you realized what the condition was, obviously you have to realign, I guess, a lot of your expectations and a lot of your views about how your lives are going to be. So what has life been like with Brendan?
Like any normal families, I guess, all of us have our own challenges. It's just that with Brendan, the challenges are slightly different. We have to... for me, it's basically I'm in the hospital with him once a week at least, seeing the therapies, and his schedule would be doing his therapy, chest therapy, physiotherapy, OT, and keeping him his immune system strong. And well, besides that, he's really a fighter. I see the strength that we have in coping so long is because Brendan has such fighting spirit that if he is not giving up, how can we give up on him? So that, I think, is what keeps us going. Yeah,
he's incredibly cheerful.
Yeah.
And in spite of, for example, when he had pneumonia, it was a very difficult period for him. But the moment he got a bit better, he's there with his big smile, right? And we draw a lot of strength from him because, you know, for someone so young, he has that ability to be able to see things in a positive way. And he's like any kid, right? He's cheeky, he's curious, he likes to play, he'll happily argue with his brother. But it's from him as well. And for us as parents, we learn what we need to do, we are disciplined to do as much as we can.
You've had to realign some of those milestones, I guess, that children usually hit. But what about his cognitive ability, you know, his speaking, his interactions?
Cognitively, for SMA kids, they're seen as normal. They're also described as particularly bright, very warm, very loving. And that's how we see Braden as well.
So, Dr. Tong, what treatment or therapy options are actually available for patients of SMA?
Yeah, I mean, compared to decades ago where things were rather limited, I think in this day and age, we have quite a number of options. For example, the most important option is to keep the child in a very healthy state. And you heard Sookie talking about giving the child the good supportive care in terms of making sure that he has his physiotherapy and occupational therapy. And basically this is to keep all the muscles supple and to prevent contractures. Those are important, as well as to prevent the spine from curving, what we call scoliosis. And the other thing that we need to maintain is his nutritional status. And that means that he has to have a very good diet, for example, and yet at the same time avoid overfeeding so that they become obese, and that's not really ideal. And also we need to make sure that the muscle remains supple, so we need to put, for example, support for the arms and legs and the heels when they are, say, sleeping at night to prevent contractures from setting in. And also, very importantly, is to maintain the lung function. And because ultimately, if the lung function deteriorates, that ultimately will put a big strain on his capability to overcome the infection and so on. So basically, these are the supportive therapy that we have. Unfortunately, we still do not have a definitive cure for SMA. There are many research that's ongoing around the world. There are many trials that are ongoing. Many of them seem to work. However, we need more data because obviously without sufficient scientific information, it's very hard to give accurate information. And therefore, we need to make it safe. And we are very hopeful that probably in a couple of years to come, there might be some real breakthroughs, and we would probably be able to help children like Brendan.
What do we know at this point in time about gene replacement therapy?
Okay, now gene replacement therapy, for the listeners who are not familiar, basically is a new type of treatment to replace a gene that is not functioning with another copy that is functioning. Actually, gene replacement therapy is not really new. For example, we have been doing, say, bone marrow transplantation, which is a form of gene replacement, except that we replace quite a whole entire set of genes. In gene replacement therapy, or gene therapy as is properly known, we are trying to replace one specific gene, for example, and that require a lot of research and work. There are some progress on this for some other genetic diseases. There were ups and downs. Unfortunately, as I said, it is not has not come into prime time as yet. So we are still hopeful that some breakthrough will come and enable to make a difference for these children.
What about assistive mobility technology? Is that something that is available for children with SMA?
Yeah, sure. I think this kind of technology is already here. For example, you have seen Stephen Hawking, for example, who has motor neuron disease, although not related to SMA. We can keep someone alive, for example, with various gadgets and devices, and we can also make them achieve milestones. For example, they are able to ambulate higher, faster, and also to keep the lung in a good shape, for example. So definitely all this assistive technology are very helpful.
Close to the home, even simple things like the iPad, right? We do see that as being assistive in a sense, because it allows him to learn and to do things which wouldn't have been available if we didn't have sort of touch screen devices. Things like powered wheelchairs is something that we're looking at closely as well, to give him that sense of independence, for which we've read, you know, makes a big difference to children who are disabled, like Brandon. And even for powered wheelchair, for example, closer to home, we are participating in a program which is funded by MOSSI, which is the Ministry of Science, Technology and Innovation, which is looking at building a brain-connected interface with a powered wheelchair, which, if we think of it long-term, you don't even need to be able to move your arms. It's just through thinking to be able to actually be mobile. So from a technology point of view, we think there's huge possibilities. I guess it's a matter of when, and a matter of costs, and a matter of availability.
Earlier, Edmund, you mentioned the fact that once you went online, you found that there were organizations and there were groups that offered support. How important do you feel is support, social and emotional, among the community of SMA patients and their families?
It's very important, because being able to reach out to someone who you don't have to explain what you're going through, immediately they get it, makes a huge world of difference. So one example was when Brandon was on his feeding tube, and we call it the Malayan incident. In Singapore, there's a Malayan, and it sort of spews out. So when he was on the feeding tube, I think there were two or three times when we were still learning then. We didn't get it quite right. So as we're feeding him, all of a sudden, he just convulses and everything comes out. And, you know, here we are panicking at, you know, midnight, 1 a.m.
Can't be calling the doctors.
Can't be calling the doctors. Google isn't helping. You know, I'm panicking. My wife's a lot calmer. And we realize, hey, we know a family in Singapore. Let's give them a call. And, you know, you give them a call, they know immediately what's happening, right? They give us a couple of tips, simple tips, and it got resolved. You know, we didn't have that incident anymore.
I think also, you know, just because you're dealing with a rare disease, it's good to have people who understand. Because I would imagine that even regular pediatricians, for example, may not be extremely well-versed in dealing with children with this condition. Dr. Tong, have you found that to be the case?
Yeah, generally, when we talk about rare diseases, it's one of those difficult situations where, because so little research has been done and so little information is available for even for professionals sometimes, there's a lot of misconception or misunderstanding that it is not important, or you know, we should not put too much attention to it and focus on common things. And I always say this, although it's individually rare, there are thousands upon thousands of rare diseases, so they are collectively very common. And because the number of children now are getting fewer in each family, the size of family is smaller, I think each child should be given all the attention that we can give. And it's very important, therefore, that members of the public, for example, that we give due attention to this group of children. For example, these conditions can happen to anyone. It does not judge who you are, where you came from. It can happen to anyone. And therefore, this kind of services and needs of these children must be addressed by society. For example, rehabilitation services, building codes, for example, for the handicapped, ramps, for example, and respite care for parents. The whole lot of services that generally we are just beginning to look into at the moment.
Currently, can we screen for this condition, and is it preventable?
Okay. Generally, screening for children are done by pediatricians and also in the government clinics, for example, in the maternal child health. Basically, how we screen them is basically asking questions related to their development. We call them developmental milestones. So if a child fails to achieve a milestone at a certain age, a red flag goes up, and they should be seen by a pediatrician or someone who is trained in assessing a child's development, so that we can identify what are the problems that a child is facing, be it SMA, autism, learning disability, and so on. So it is very important that all children should have regular assessment of the developmental milestones. As regards to whether this condition can be prevented, I would assume that you mean whether there is a cure. So we have talked about that.
Or rather, with prenatal genetic testing.
So prenatal diagnosis is available in Malaysia. And it is done, for example, if we know the genetic background to that disease. It is possible, for example, for a woman in her first trimester of pregnancy, we can now perform a procedure called chorionic villus sampling at about 11 weeks onwards by a trained obstetrician. And they could isolate the DNA from the fetus and make a diagnosis. And the parents would have to make a decision. Should the fetus be affected, whether to keep the pregnancy or not? It's entirely up to the couple and the family to decide.
Edmund, Suki, what are your hopes for your son?
Well, we are treating Brandon just like any other kid. But most importantly is we would like him, we'll keep him as healthy as we can. The one hope I have seen is from a family who has the girl who is now a teenager. And today she's flying off to Cambridge to read law. She has SMA 2 just like Brandon. I think that gives us hope that, a child with SMA or any kind of disability shouldn't be deprived of education, to just be like a normal child. Yeah.
And to have all those opportunities and potential.
Yeah.
To grow up and understand that, they have a lot of possibilities. And not to believe that life in any way does limit them. They are, different challenges, but to see that life has a lot of possibility and to reach out.
And finally, what message would you all like to leave us with on the subject of spinal muscular atrophy?
Our kids are absolutely amazing, right? And the way that we see it is they lead the way. We're here to support them, and if you look at children who have SMA, for example, and the girl that we just talked about, that's very inspirational, and we'd like people to believe that. We would like to be able to reach out to other families with children with SMA, adults with SMA, and to come together and pull together our experiences and extend what we're able to achieve together, right, for our children.
For me, SMA causes disability physically, but not to the mind and the spirit. So it's not all gloom and doom. Live life to the fullest. Yeah.
I'm always amazed by parents like Edmund and Suki, because these are the silent heroes, people who work in the background tirelessly 24/7, get no credit, but they get all the love and they get all the respect from people who are out there. And I think society should always treasure families like this, because these are the ones who give real value to the to our society and how we actually should proceed from there. That's very good.
Thank you very much, everybody. I've been speaking to Edmund Lim and Lim Suk Yi, parents to a 4-year-old child with spinal muscular atrophy, as well as Professor Dr. M.K. Thong, geneticist. We have been discussing a rare genetic disease, spinal muscular atrophy, on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.